Random House Audio presents The Widower's Tale by Julia Glass, read for you by Mark Bramhall. In the way that a gambler who has lost can easily imagine himself again in possession of his money, thinking how false, how undeserved was the process that took it from him, so he sometimes found himself unwilling to believe what had happened, or certain that his marriage would somehow be found again. So much of it was still in existence. James Salter, Light Years. Chapter 1.
"Why, thank you. I'm getting in shape to die." Those were the first words I spoke aloud on the final Thursday in August of last summer. Thursday, I recall for certain because it was the day on which I read in our weekly town paper about the first of what I would so blithely come to call the Crusades. The end of the month, I can also say for certain, because Elves and Fairies was scheduled that very evening to fling open its brand-new, gloriously purple doors, formerly the entrance to my beloved barn, and usher in another flight of tiny, perfect children, along with their preened and privileged parents. I was on the return stretch of my route du jour, the sun just gaining a vista over the trees, when a youngster who lives half a mile down my street gave me a thumbs up and drawled, "Use it or lose it, man." I might have ignored his insolence had he been pruning a hedge or fetching the newspaper, but he appeared merely to be lounging and smoking a cigarette on his parents' hyper-fastidiously weed-free lawn. He wore tattered trousers a foot too long and the smile of a bartender who wishes to convey that you've had one too many libations. I stopped, jogging in place, and elaborated on my initial remark. "Because, you see, lad," I informed him, huffing rhythmically, though still in control, "I have it on commendable authority that dying is hard work, requiring diligence, stamina, and fortitude, which I intend to maintain in ample supply until the moment of truth arrives." And this was no lie. 3 months before, at my daughter's Memorial Day cookout, I'd overheard one of her colleagues confide to another in solemn, Hippocratic tones, "Maternity nurses love to talk about how hard it is to be born, how it's anything but passive. They explain to all these new-age moms that babies come out exhausted from the work they do, how they literally muscle their way toward the light. Well, if you ask me, dying's the same. It's hard work, too. The final stretch is a marathon. I've seen patients try to die, but fail. Just one more thing they didn't bother to tell us in med school." Creepy, this talk of muscling one's way toward the dark. Though I did enjoy the concept of all those babies toiling away, lives on the line, like ancient Roman tunnel workers determined to complete their passage. As for the youngster with trousers slouched around his bony ankles, my homily had its intended effect. When I finished, he hadn't a syllable at his service, not even the knee-jerk "whatever" that members of his generation mutter when conversationally cornered. As I went on my way, energized by vindication, I had a dim notion that the youngster's name was Damien, or Darius. I put him at 15, the nadir point of youth. Had he been a boy of his age some 20 years ago, I would have known his name without a second thought, not just because I would have known his parents, but because in all likelihood he would have mowed my lawn or painted my barn, gratefully, for an hourly wage appropriate to a teenage boy's modestly spendthrift habits. Nowadays teenage boys with wealthy parents do not mow lawns or paint houses. If they stoop to any sort of paid activity, they help seasoned citizens learn to navigate the baffling world of computers and entertainment modules, charging an hourly wage more appropriate to the appallingly profligate habits of a drug dealer in the Bronx.
Damius, or Darian, might indeed have been the one to coach my own seasoned self through the use of my new laptop computer, a retirement gift that spring from my daughters, and to fleece me accordingly, had I not been the fortunate grandfather of a very intelligent, very kind, adequately well-mannered boy of 20, who was, at the time, an honors student at Harvard. A good boy, as parents no longer dare to say, cowed by advice from some celebrity pediatrician who's probably fathered two or three litters with a sequence of abandoned wives. But that's what Robert was to me, and still is, or is again, despite everything that's happened. A good boy, on the verge of becoming a solid, productive citizen. My grandson is a very good boy, I used to say, with pride and confidence, especially within earshot of his mother. Robert had inherited his mother's passion for science, and I had begun to assume, with mixed feelings, that he planned to follow in her professional footsteps, a successful oncologist in Boston. Trudy has become marginally famous as a media source whenever some new Scandinavian study pops up to hint at anything approaching a cure. One day, watching her as she explained a controversial drug to that life-size Ken doll on the 6 o'clock news, it occurred to me that my younger daughter entered my living room more often as a guest of NBC than as my flesh-and-blood offspring. I saw Robert far more frequently. Robert stayed in close touch with me, as contractors, carpenters, plumbers, and electricians jacked up and tore apart my barn so that it could become the new home of elves and fairies, Matlock's favorite progressive nursery school. Simply to look out my back windows that summer felt like spying on the public humiliation of a loyal friend, an ordeal I had engineered. When these callow strangers, few of whom spoke English by choice, were not perpetrating their mutilations, buttressings, and vigorous eviscerations upon that stately structure, they treated my entire property like an amusement park. During breaks, they would kick a soccer ball back and forth by the pond, and while there were plenty of other shady spots in which to lounge, they ate their lunch on the steps of my back porch, their laughter and indecipherable chit-chat echoing throughout my house. I could not even identify the language they shared. It might have been Tagalog or Farsi. Fortuitously, despite my protests, Robert had insisted on setting up an email account when he tutored me on the use of my laptop. After decades at a job where the King Kong shadow of technology loomed ever larger and darker over the simple work I loved, I had fantasies of a quasi-Luddite retirement. I would revel in the pages of one obscurely significant novel after another, abandoning the world of gigabytes and hard drives. Cursed be the cursors! Farewell to iEverything and all its pertly nicknamed apps. In a word, ha! That summer, as it turned out, I found my sleek, alarmingly versatile computer a blessing, chiefly because it meant that I heard regularly from Robert, who was working at a coastal conservation outfit up in Maine. He kept me sane by sympathizing with my fury about everything from the cigarette butts and gum wrappers I found in the forsythia bushes to the dozens of alien soda pop cans I had to haul, along with my own recycling, to the transfer station. Most insulting was the altered view from my desk, my copper beach so rudely upstaged by a large blue closet concealing a toilet. That Thursday, finally, the Blue John was carted away. The workmen were gone. My good deed was coming to fruition, and I was determined to put myself in a positive frame of mind. Yes, I was irritated by the youth in the baggy trousers and all that he personified, but he was just one sign among many that the world was changing its colors without my permission. Yes, I was apprehensive about the looming loss, possibly permanent, of certain privileges I had long taken for granted, peace, privacy, and, my daughter Clover had recently informed me, swimming naked in the pond before dark. But I had been led to expect these vexations, and I was...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?